You're listening to a resource from the Finding Truth Conference, an apologetics event hosted by Cedarville University and sponsored by the North American Mission Board and Crossings Ministries. The event took place in February of 2017 on the campus of Cedarville University in Cedarville, Ohio. We pray this resource is an encouragement to you as you stand for the faith once for all delivered to the saints.
Okay, let's go ahead and get started. There could be a couple more people coming in. So, I'm Dr. J. Argil-Hooley. I'm Dr. J. Argil-Hooley, and this session is, Oh No, God Really Does Exist, Understanding and Using the Ontological Argument. So, what I plan to do is give you the simplest possible version of the ontological argument, and then we'll go through two popular versions. One is a very important historical version of the argument, and the other is recently what has got philosophers of religion excited. I'll try to talk about how it works and what it's intended to try to do. So we'll start with the simplest sort of argument, which is the three-premised one I have written for you here, and we'll go from there. Now, the ontological argument is distinct from the other apologetic arguments you might be more familiar with, like the cosmological argument, which is, hey, everything moves. Something had to get that going. God exists. Or the teleological argument, which is we see all these things that have design-like features. Usually that means they were designed. God exists. Or the fine-tuning argument. Things couldn't be the way that they are and have creatures like us unless God existed, because the probability would be outrageous, and so on. So typically arguments of that sort, they start with an observation we make about our world, which is sort of a shared human experience of the world, like things move, or we see design features, or the world is complex, or something like that. And then they proceed from that to show the best explanation for that, or the right inference from that fact, is that God exists. The ontological argument is not like that. It's an what's called an a priori argument, and that means it's an argument from a definition. So the idea behind the ontological argument is if we understand what it means to say that there is a God, then it follows that there's a God. And so there's a couple of different ways we might try to show that's the case, and we'll walk through each of those in turn. So here's the simplest form. Premise one, if it's possible that God exists, then God exists. Premise two, it is possible that God exists. Premise three, or conclusion, therefore, God exists. Okay? So this is a logically valid argument, and what it means to say that an argument is valid is that it has the right sort of shape or structure, so that if the premises are true, the conclusion follows. I would not need to have written the conclusion. I could have just put these on the board, and anybody sensible could have guessed what three was supposed to be. Now, the trick behind the argument is it looks like that the controversial premise for the layperson is going to be one, because it seems way too quick to say that if it's possible that God exists, then God exists. But actually, the controversial premise for philosophers is two, it's possible that God exists. And one is relatively trivial on certain kinds of modal logic. So I'll try to develop that a little bit more. At this point, what's important to see is that an ontological argument could be given simply as this, and there are many different valid ways you might construe the argument, okay? So the idea here is there's some fact about God such that if it's even possible that God exists, he does exist. That's the kind of key fact about God that's doing the work here. Okay, so we'll look at the first version. It's from Anselm. It's 11th century in a book he writes where he discovers what God is as he's praying to God. And on the basis of his discovery of what God is, he comes up with a little argument that shows, given what God is, he exists necessarily. He could not fail to exist. Now, that makes God different than you or me. I could have failed to exist. So we can imagine the world being relevantly different so that my parents never met, in which case I wouldn't exist. The idea behind a concept of God is you can't imagine there not being a God, since part of what it means for there to be a God is that he exists and holds everything together. And so Anselm tries to capitalize on that idea about God and show from the idea of God that God exists. So I'll go through this pretty slowly. One, Here's his definition of God. He says, God is that than which no greater can be conceived, which is a mouthful, admittedly. God is that than which no greater can be conceived. So what Anselm means by saying this is God is the maximally great being. He's the highest conceivable thing. So if we think about the greatest thing ever, that's what we would describe as God. And this also implies, he goes on to say later, this implies certain facts about God, right? Because we can conceive of properties that something might have that would make them better. So if you knew more, you would be better than you are now. That would be better, right? And if you were holier, that would be better. If you were more powerful, that would be better. And so it sort of pulls on those types of ideas that we have. What we mean by God is minimally a personal being that exists, that is all-powerful, that is all-knowing, that is morally perfect, in addition to whatever else we might think about God. So he says this is a pretty good starting minimal definition for what it means for something to be God. So he says, to God, God, I found out what you are. You are that than which no greater can be conceived. You're the greatest conceivable thing. Okay, premise two. From here, we'll depart a little from Anselm and we'll just try to put an argument together. Let's start with this assumption. God might exist. God might exist. That's not normally one that people, at least as they're going through the argument, would want to contest. To say that it's not true, that two is false, would be to say it's impossible that God exists, which is an incredibly strong claim. That would mean that something about the idea of God was self-contradictory. Otherwise, it wouldn't be possible to show that he did not exist necessarily. And all we're committing ourselves to with this premise, at least at first glance, is the idea that there might be that than which no greater can be conceived. There might be this greatest conceivable thing. Okay, so God might exist. Premise three. This is what's called, as I have there in the brackets, a reductio assumption. So a reductio is a particular type of argument. In a reductio, what we try to do is assume what our opponent believes and show that what our opponent believes leads us to a contradictory claim. Now, the reason we want to do that is if we can show that an opponent's claim leads to a contradictory claim, that means there's something wrong with what they said, since contradictions cannot stand. So say, well, hey, if we believe what you think, this contradiction arises. And no one can believe in a contradiction, so no one should agree with your claim. And so Anselm was starting here with the claim that God exists only in our understanding and not in our reality, and not in reality. So that's, he has this idea from the fool says that there is no God, right? So in order for the fool to deny that there's God, he has to at least have the idea of God, that is God, the idea, has to exist in his understanding. And when the fool says there is no God, he's not denying that you and I have an idea of what God is. He's denying that sort of out there, there's a God, independent of the idea that we have of him. So this would represent for Anselm the atheist's position, or the position of the fool. God exists only in our understanding and not in reality. Now what Anselm wants to do is to show that that assumption, or that claim by the atheist, leads to a contradiction. And if he can show that, then we have to reject the atheist position, and we have to accept Anselm's position. So here's how he tries to make that argument work. God exists only in our understanding and not in reality. That's the claim. Now Anselm says there's something interesting about that. If God exists only in our understanding, then we could conceive of him being greater. Okay? So this is referred to sometimes as Anselm's principle. So what does it mean to say we could conceive of God being greater? If God's just an idea you have, we could conceive of God being greater. We could conceive of him actually existing. He could actually be the thing, the one, who's all-knowing and all-powerful and morally perfect. He could actually be the one who made all things, and he could actually be self-existent and eternal, and he could actually be whatever else we say about him. If he's just an idea in our head, or that we kind of share, say because we're afraid of that the universe is falling apart at the seams and we project some need for a God into existence or something, then he's just an idea, that's it. And he's no more potent than an idea. But certainly if he were real, that would make him to be greater than he now is, because now he's just an idea that we happen to have. But we can't conceive of him as being greater, says Anselm, Because God is that than which no greater can be conceived. So if someone says, well, God is just an idea that we happen to have, at minimally, they're equivocating. They're talking about something other than God. And if they really mean what they're saying, then they're saying God cannot be greater than can be, or cannot be greater because he is that than which no greater can be conceived. And he's that than which a greater can be conceived, because you could conceive of him actually existing. So what that means is, from one, with this idea, line 5 now, we cannot conceive of him being greater, that would actually mean that 3 has led us to a contradiction, which is present on lines 4 and 5. If it's true that God exists only in our understanding, then he could be better. But by definition, he can't be better. So unless we're prepared to say God can be greater and he can't be, which is patent nonsense, we should reject the atheist's claim and say God does not exist only in the understanding, but in reality as well. And that's the that shows how premise 3 of the argument reduces to absurdity. That is, it makes us think something contradictory, and therefore we can reject it. So this is Anselm's version of the argument. God is that than which no greater can be conceived. That is the definition of God. That's what the word God means. We start with the assumption that God might exist, because it seems like there could be a that than which no greater could be conceived. If we start also with the opposing assumption that God is just this idea and not something that exists in reality, we run into the trouble that the idea we have is not as great as God, the thing we said could exist. And so we have a contradiction, and since contradictions can't stand, we should infer that God does not only exist in the understanding, but in reality as well. So this is the sort of classic ontological argument. Okay, I'll pause for a second there and take any questions you might have. I'll go to the next one, and then we'll do some more questions after that. Yes?
Was Anselm really arguing against atheists at the time? Who is he arguing against?
His argument is with the fool from the Psalms, who says there is no God. How could anyone confess that? How could they say that?
But in the historical context, was there anybody actually making the case that there's no God?
There are people who are making the case that there's no God at the time, but it wouldn't be nothing like the sort of strident, open rejection of the idea of God that we have now. And it would not have constituted a popular position whatsoever. Anselm is in part involved in a project to try to figure out the extent to which our natural, unaided human reason can draw conclusions about God. Now, it's taken for granted that there's lots of things about God that we cannot know on the basis of philosophy, that God would have to have told us. But Anselm's idea, and the idea of much of the Middle Ages, I think the right idea, is that God can be known is something that's accessible to everybody in the way things have been made. Now, he's actually arguing that just from the idea of God, we could demonstrate that there was a God, and that's what seems to be somewhat revolutionary. Now, his main opponent, we'll talk about the counter-arguments in a minute, but his main opponent at the time he's writing this in the 11th century is actually a different priest who says this is not a successful argument, nice try, and we'll try to explain in a bit why that's the case. Other questions about this argument at this time? Yes? Sure. So premise 3 is our reductio assumption. God exists only in our understanding and not in reality. So the idea of a reductio argument is we take the assumption or the position of the opposition in any context in what we're arguing. We take the claim that they make and we show that their claim leads us to some contradictory idea. So somebody's arguing with us and we say, hold on, are you saying X? They say, yes. We go, great. If X is true, this nonsense follows that no one should believe. And that's the proof that X is not true. So in this case, the nonsense no one should believe is that God can be greater and can't be. And that follows from the claim that he exists only in our understanding and not in reality. Okay, so how would someone respond to this type of argument? Well, the classic response comes from one of Anselm's confreres, a guy named Gaunilo, and he says, this is not going to work as an argument or a piece of natural theology because we can reproduce the argument, and as long as we substitute something in the right place, We can prove the existence of just anything. So we can take out the word God and we can put in something else, okay? So the example I use is Charlie. Let's make the argument for Charlie's existence. Premise one, Charlie is that boyfriend than which no greater can be conceived. Now, Charlie might exist. There's nothing wrong with thinking that there's a greatest conceivable boyfriend. Let's suppose that he's just an idea we happen to have and not a real guy. What follows? Well, if he's just an idea, he's not as great as he could be. He could be better. He could be real. But now he could be greater, and he can't be, so Charlie exists. Now, Ganilo doesn't use Charlie the boyfriend. He talks about an island, which would be perfect. But his idea is, the only reason this argument works is because of the definition. And as long as you substitute something in for God and the that than, then you could use this to prove just anything. So that's the counter-argument. So the weakness of the counter-argument, says Anselm, I think he's got this right, is that it's not at all obvious which properties you would have to be the greatest possible island or the greatest possible boyfriend, right? Let's just take boyfriend. There's certain principles that everybody could agree a boyfriend ought to have. He ought to be kind, handsome, funny, right? Rich. Polite, rich, okay, so there you go. I mean, see, everybody understands these things, right? But there are other sorts of properties a boyfriend might have, and we have no way to say whether they would tend to make him greater or less, right? So I'm 5'9", my wife says 5'8", and my wife is 5'5". And so when she saw me at the time that I could be a boyfriend, 5'9" was a pretty good height for a girl who's 5'5". If I had been 7'3", that might not have blossomed into the romance we now have, right? But somebody who's significantly taller than my wife, say a professional basketball player, if she's 6'6", she might want a boyfriend who's 7'3", or something like that. Well, we have a hard time saying which is the better boyfriend, the super tall one or the one of average height. Well, it depends on your point of view. And likewise, if we take Ganilo's example, which is the perfect island, he says, well, there's an island, that then which no greater can be conceived. And he runs the same argument. We could ask Ganilo, suppose we add an additional grain of sand to the island. Is it better or worse? Well, there doesn't seem to be any scale there. So the argument then is the reason that there's no problem in talking about God is because when we say God is that then which nothing greater can be conceived, we haven't talked about any sort of nonsense being. Now remember earlier when we looked at this argument, I said the controversial premise was not the first one, it was the second one. It was the controversial premise was it is possible that God exists. And likewise here, the controversial premise is premise two. God might exist. So in order to rebut the argument, you'd really have to show that it is impossible that God exists. And whereas it seems we can show that it's impossible that there's a Charlie, since he would be different for every woman who might want a boyfriend, and it would be different islands for every person who's dreamed of having an island, it doesn't seem like the properties that we assign to God, like all-powerful, all-knowing, loving, holy, etc., are things you would want anyone to have less of. Or that there's any significant debate about which of these properties would tend to make God greater than he is. So Anselm rejects this sort of parody argument that is given by Ganilo by saying that God and Charlie the boyfriend or the island that might exist or the world's perfect, you know, sub-sandwich or whatever, they're just not the same kind of thing. And so we're not able to make the similar sort of definition of them. There's a second point, too, which is that for Anselm and the Christian tradition, that is the definition of God. It isn't as if Anselm said, you know, I'm having a hard time proving God's existence. Let me cook up a clever definition for what it means to be God. He said, this is just what our religion teaches. God's the best. He's the greatest thing we could conceive. In fact, our religion actually teaches a bit more than that. It teaches he's a bit more than we can conceive, and he has to reveal himself to us so that we can understand what he wants us to know about him. So Anselm thinks these sorts of rejoinders that he gets from Ganilo are not ultimately successful. Having said that, there's a different way we could give the argument, and philosophers have done this much more recently, contemporary analytic philosophers, and it doesn't involve the same kind of complaint from the parody. So we'll look at the second version of this argument now. Yes?
Doesn't it depend on what you mean by greater? I was just thinking of your comparison to Charlie. We have different definitions of what the greatest boyfriend would be. What is greater mean? Greater in what way? Because that could be different also. You know, greatest in love, greatest in power.
So, yeah, there's some question exactly about whether a particular property would tend to make God greater or less. And you could take that to mean, morally better, in which case, on the question of morality, for example, we'd want him to be as moral as he could be, since it would always be better to be more moral than less. So it's just a sort of flat comparative. And if you think about the idea of God, is it better to have a God who is morally perfect and always and everywhere able to accomplish his will, or to have a slightly dirtbaggy God? Well, obviously one of those is better, right? So the idea is, when we say greater, we would mean, you could either take that to mean like preferable in some objective sense, or you could take it to take, as Anselm actually means it, to say that he participates more fully in what it means to be the good. And we could come back to that maybe a little bit later. Okay, version number 2. Here we have a slightly different definition of God that's intended to capture Anselm's insight. And the definition of God is that he is a maximally great being. Maximally great being. So what it means for God to be a maximally great being is, here's the stipulative definition, he is all-knowing, all-powerful, morally perfect, and necessary. Now, the necessary one, you might say, well, what's that? Well, the idea is God is self-existent. And this is an attribute that the Christian religion has conceived God to have, and Christian theologians have said that God has forever. He's the uncreated one who creates. He doesn't require an explanation. And no matter how things were, he would be there. God could have chosen not to create any of us, but there isn't a conceivable set of circumstances in which there isn't a God. That's part of what it means for there to be a God. So God is the maximally great being, premise 1. Premise 2, it is possible that God exists. So you notice that's the same as this. It's also the same as the claim in the previous argument, premise 2, that God might exist. It's possible that God exists. Now, in order for that premise to be wrong or a faulty assumption, you would have to argue that it is not possible that God exists. In other words, you would have to argue that the idea of God is self-contradictory. Now, the evidence against that is that we're making fluent use of the idea right now and in every debate we have with anyone. And that was part of Anselm's insight, too. The fool makes use of this idea. He doesn't say it's nonsense to talk about God in the way you could say it's nonsense to talk about the square circle or the color green having a smell or something like that. We make fluent use of this idea of God. And so we're putting the sort of the weight on the person who wants to disagree with the success of this argument to show that it's impossible that God exists. And that's a really high bar. Okay, premise 3. If it is possible that God exists, then he exists in a possible world. Okay, so that's somewhat opaque. I'll try to suss that out. There's a type of semantics that's used in contemporary modal logic, which is called possible world semantics. And all it means to say that there is a possible world is that things could have been a particular way. That's it. So the talk about worlds is not there's another planet or some galaxy or something like that. It's there's a certain state of affairs that could have existed. For example, I'm wearing a black tie with white spots. It could have been that I wore a green tie or a red one or something. I mean, we can imagine that. It's conceivable. There doesn't seem to be any contradiction in it. So there's a possible world then where I wore a different tie or where I don't exist or where we're all a little bit taller or we're all facing the other side of the room or something else. So the possible worlds language is just a way logicians try to talk about what could have been different and what could not have been different. So I'll give you an example of something logicians think could not have been different. It could not have been that 2 and 2 add up to something other than 4. Because what it means for 2 to be added to 2 is 4. So we couldn't have 2 and 2 equaling 5. But we could have you all being bearded or having an extra arm or something like that, right? So some things could be different, and other things, it seems, could not be. So when we say it's possible that God exists, all we're saying in the possible world's semantics is that We can imagine a situation where there's God and he made the world. There's a perfectly coherent, meaning logically coherent story we can tell about God making the world. And that seems right, since many religions tell that kind of a story. If it's possible that God exists, then he exists in a possible world. Okay, next premise. This is the one that strikes people as odd. If God exists in a possible world, then he exists in all possible worlds. That's the one that strikes people as odd. What's interesting is, this is just a modal axiom in what we call S5 modal logic. It's just a modal axiom, so it's a fact about the logical system. So this isn't controversial among philosophers, even though it sounds really bizarre. The idea is like this. One of the things we have in our idea of God is that he is self-existent. He's his own explanation, and he exists necessarily, if at all. So if he exists necessarily. He has to be, and everything else is a creation that he made. That's at the fundamental component of the Christian worldview, for example. You've got creator and everything else. The everything else does not have to be, and he can make it different in many respects. But God just is who he is, and he would have to be. So our definition of God, if you'll recall, is that he's all-knowing, all-powerful, morally perfect, and necessary. So that is to say, if he's necessary, he exists in all the possible worlds. So if somebody admits that there's a concurrent story that we could tell about a being like that existing in one of these ways, then it follows on the modal system I was describing that he exists in every other world. And that's actually not controversial among philosophers, unless they use a different modal system that has less entailments. But this is a valid argument in that system. Now, if God exists in all possible worlds, then he exists in the actual one, the one that God made, since that's one of the possible ways things are. And to say that he exists in the actual world is just to say that he exists, and we have that by hypothetical syllogism. In other words, this is a logically valid argument. Now, as I was saying, it's not really contestable, premises 3, 4, 5, and 6, that they are valid under certain and popular schemes of modal reasoning. What would be debated then would be premise 2, the idea that it was possible that God exists. But that means it's incumbent on the atheist to show us that it is impossible that God exists, and that's a very difficult thing to try to do. In fact, I think you can't do it since God exists, but if you wanted to try to do it, it would be a hard test no matter what you were trying to show necessarily did not exist. The way to show that something necessarily does not exist is to show that the concept is contradictory. Like I can say there are no square circles. Is that right, Dr. Hammett? There are no square circles, right? In Euclidean space. Okay, so the idea is it makes sense to say if I have a certain definition that's nonsense, I can conclude that there aren't any of those things, right? Here's another one that's very common as an example. There aren't any married bachelors. I don't think anyone will dispute this, right? Because what it means to be a bachelor is that you aren't married. So there couldn't be a married one. He wouldn't be a bachelor anymore, right? So the idea is we have certain concepts that we can talk about and kind of use fluently, but they can't refer to anything since they're an impossible kind of idea. Unless God, the maximally great being, is an idea with a strong enough family resemblance to an idea like married bachelor, you're not able to show that it's a nonsense idea, a contradictory one, in which case you couldn't show that two is false, in which case the rest follows almost without controversy among logicians. So again, the strength of the argument is, in part, that it puts a tremendous kind of bar for the atheist to leap over. He'd have to show that God necessarily does not exist, that the concept is nonsense. And Christians are in a position to know that can't be done, since he exists and we know him. Okay, let me stop there. Questions about this type of argument, this type of version of the argument? Yeah?
So I think it's the first statement, if God exists in a possible world, then he exists in all possible worlds. That's just basically that's the meaning of necessary.
Correct? Yes.
Okay.
That's it.
And then HS, what does that stand for?
Hypothetical syllogism. So we say it's possible that God exists. That plugs into premise 3, where it says if it is possible that God exists. So now we get what follows. He exists in a possible world. Now we take that he exists in a possible world, and we move it down to the next line. He exists in a possible world. He exists in all possible worlds. So we move over and take that, and we move it down to the next line. He exists in all possible worlds. He exists in the actual one. That means he exists. So that's all the HS signifies. Yes?
So the burden of proof is upon the atheist leaving theism as a default position.
I think so, since it is conceivable that there is an all-knowing, all-powerful, morally perfect, necessary being. And our evidence that it's conceivable is that every monotheistic religion says that, right? So this won't be an argument for the Christian God, or the God of the Bible, the true God, but it is an argument for all-knowing, all-powerful, morally perfect, necessary being, and nobody but our God could be that. We'd need a different argument to show that that was the case. Yes?
When you're talking about like square circles and married bachelors, could you talk about like a virgin birth being included to that? Because I know people tend to draw that as a... What is the logic?
Well, I think in that case you're dealing with... So the question's about a virgin birth. Is that a contradictory idea? The birth, certainly not, right? The virgin conception, that's what's really surprising. But in this case, when we say virgin, that is referring to the fact that Joseph did not know Mary before she became pregnant with Jesus. But the explanation for how Jesus is conceived is through the power of the Holy Spirit. So the birth activity, that happens as normally described, you know, human development, so far as we know. And the conception happens in a way that does not change the fact that she's a virgin, since there isn't any sexual intercourse leading to the conception of Jesus. So in this case, you do have a virgin birth, and we don't have a contradiction, since the virginity is referring to the interaction she had with Joseph, and the conception is effect of the Holy Spirit. Yes?
Could you clarify that last, next to the last one, the if then? Could you explain that again?
The if God exists in all possible worlds, then he exists in the actual one?
Yeah.
So the actual world, the one we live in, the one we're in right now, hello, is just one of the ways things could have been. It's just the way God made it. Right? So presumably God could have made things differently if he had wanted to. And this is the way he chose to make things. So this is one of the possibilities, it's just the actual one. So when we say God exists, we don't mean in somebody's imagination, or there's this idea of God that could have existed, or something like that, or exists in a book. We mean he is the creator of this world that we live in. And so we just need to move from his existence in the possible worlds as a kind of conception that we have to his existence in this world. And since this world is one of the possible ones, he exists. Now, the world is not the created thing. The world is the state of affairs that describes the way things are. So you don't want to think of the world as like a planet that he made or something like that. It's the state of affairs that describes how things are. Yes? No. And the reason they would not is because the possible world semantics is considered to be an incredibly powerful illustrative device in areas of philosophy that don't pertain to this argument. And not everyone who generates the possible world semantics and all of its logics and outworkings is a Christian. So you could reject the modal system because it had this consequence. But it wasn't generated so that we could have this consequence. Because as we saw, there was already an argument that was somewhat similar without any conception, any non-primitive conception of modal logic 1,000 years before this argument arose. Good question. Any other questions about this? Yes?
What would happen if you said it's possible that God doesn't exist? Except for some atheists try and co-opt it and say, like, well, if you just said instead of it's possible he does... possible that he doesn't. Would it follow the same way exactly or no?
Well, you'd have to say it's possible that there's not a all-knowing, all-powerful, morally perfect, necessary being. So it's possible that he's not necessary. That would be to say that he's not necessary, which is just to change the definition. Does that make sense? So I don't think that that's ultimately successful. There are some people who've made those sorts of parity arguments, there have been some, I think, pretty successful responses to them in the literature. They're quite technical, but I'd be happy to give you some papers afterward if you'd like to talk about that. Other questions about the... we're on the understanding part. Are there any other questions about that? Okay, so now we'll talk a little bit about the use. You don't see this trotted out very often, and part of the reason is because of the sort of three or four standard arguments for God's existence, which would be cosmological, teleological, moral, and this one. It's probably the most conceptually difficult, and it's the one that feels to the unbeliever the most like a parlor trick. Okay? It feels like you defined your way to victory, or you used some logical wordplay, or something happened, and it shouldn't work. And yet, for that type of objection, it received significant commentary since the time of Anselm by nearly every major modern philosopher, and many of the great even atheist philosophers of the 20th century. Bertrand Russell, for example, tells a story in one of his books. He's walking down the lane, and he realizes the argument's sound. That is, that it's valid and the premises are true. That is, oh no, God exists. He later changed his mind, but the idea is it captured attention enough to say, I have to think about the conception that's involved here. So for people of a particular temperament, it's a way to engage their reasoning, particularly because one of its effects, even if it doesn't ultimately convince anybody that God exists, one of its major effects, and this is what Plantinga writes about in his book, The Nature of Necessity, is that it's valid, and the premise, it's possible that God exists, is highly plausible on any number of arguments. And so, minimally, it shows that the belief in God, the all-knowing, all-powerful, morally perfect, necessary being, created the world, is rational. One of the biggest tools apologetics does for us is it shows that the sorts of claims that the Christian faith is making, like there's a God, are rational claims. So it just won't do for the atheist to say, this is this nonsense, ridiculous sort of thing for you to believe in. No, not at all. Actually, here's a valid proof of it on S5 logic, which is highly rigorous sort of argument that you could bring to give to somebody, and that perplexes a lot of philosophers at high levels of precision in the academy. So it won't be enough any longer for someone to just say, well, that's just silly or that's just nonsense. In other words, it provokes somebody to have to think about their position. And this, I think, is one of the main benefits of apologetics. I mean, one of the things apologetics does best is it provokes the person to consider the hasty claim that this is all a bunch of nonsense. Now, it's very important to see that if the argument's not ultimately successful in convincing somebody that God exists, that really doesn't count as much of a failure for the argument. Right. In general, our arguments as Christian apologists are not they shouldn't be intended or thought to bring somebody into the fold of God, because that's what the gospel does. What this sort of argument does is it shows that the attacks on the Christian faith, particularly those having to do with its claims that it's not rational or it's silly or it's misguided in a very safe, that can't be right. Here's any number of arguments that we're able to give, some of them very sophisticated, which show that it is rational to believe that God exists. They may not ultimately be the reasons that we happen to believe and confess the God that we confess, or to believe in Jesus, for example, but they are reasons to show that it is not only plausible, but rational to believe these things and to confess them about God. And that changes the playing field significantly. One of the other effects of apologetics is, as I said, is to show that its attacks on the faith are not necessarily true. This does even better than that. This says, actually, you have much more to do to deny the existence of God than merely to say, I don't have any evidence that he exists. Or I don't want to believe in a God like that. Or I think your book is old and dusty and full of errors. Or any number of other things. In order to rebut this argument on the front end, the most obvious line of attack is to show that it's impossible that there's a being like that. And most atheists don't approach the argument that way. They just try to say something like, there's no evidence for this, or something like that. Actually, here's great evidence. There's evidence that it's possible that God exists, since we're talking about him. And it turns out that it follows on modal ontological argument that he does exist as a consequence of that. Now, that's highly annoying, or feels a bit like a parlor trick, as I said. But the idea is we can no longer just say that the burden of proof would be entirely on us in the arena of argument. It seems actually this argument would suggest it's the other way. Now, the atheist can always say that his intuitions are opposite, and he could sort of say nobody would be convinced by this argument who wasn't already convinced that it was possible that God exists. But it's one thing to say, I don't think it's possible that God exists, and it's something else to show what's wrong with the idea so that he can't exist. And the task of showing that the concept of God is the same, structurally, as the concept of a married bachelor, that hasn't really been successfully accomplished. Now, I'll show you one way somebody might try to do that. One way somebody might try to do that is by picking on one of the concepts of God's existence. And after picking on one of the parts of what it means to say that God exists, they'll try to show that that concept alone is incoherent. So a very common one would be omnipotence. So omnipotence is understood to mean that God is all-powerful. And the sort of parlance way we say what that means is we say something like, God can do anything. Okay? Now, if that's actually what the Christian religion means when it says that God is all-powerful, then it turns out that this is not a very good definition, since the Christian religion tells us things God can't do, like sin, for example, or be tempted. So this won't turn out to be a very good definition of omnipotence. But it's not obvious in the first place that that shows that the concept of God is incoherent. It just tells us something about this sort of vernacular understanding of what it means for God to be omnipotent. And the sort of highest and best of our philosophy and theology in the Christian religion has never made this claim about God. So there's a chance that when an atheist is targeting some part of God and saying that's an incoherent idea, they're targeting something that Christians aren't really intending to confess, at least not in this way. Another one would be arguments about the nature of God's moral goodness and the existence of evil in the world. So there are some arguments to the effect that given the kind and scope of evil in the world that we're very clear about, it is impossible that there be a God who is morally perfect, because a morally perfect God would never allow such evils and so forth. But an attempt to make an argument like that is now requires a completely different set of analysis, and we're dealing with a completely different set of apologetical arguments. So somebody could try to attack the definition of God, and typically that's what they'll do. They'll try to show that one of the attributes is inconsistent with itself, or they'll try to show that one of the attributes is inconsistent with some fact about our world, right? Another common one would be all-knowing, and they'll say, well, men are free in this particular way, and how could God be all-knowing if men are free in that particular way? Well, an easy out there for the Christian is to just say we're not free in that particular way. Many people don't want to do that, and so they're left to come up with some other sort of alternative answer. But the idea is, on any of these constraints, it seems at least at first glance that this is a perfectly coherent understanding of God, and it's one, at minimally, that lots and lots of people make fluent use of. Okay? Questions about any of that? Yeah?
So would this argument just prove the existence of anything that we define to be necessary?
Good. So we'll go back to Ganilo's argument, right? He could just say, if an island is perfect, obviously it's real and out there. Otherwise it wouldn't be perfect, right? I could think of it as being better. So it's really got to be out there. And so you could say, well, can't you just use this argument for any necessary sort of thing? Anselm's response is, one, yeah, maybe. It would have to be the kind of thing we would actually conceive of to be necessary, though. And most of the suggestions are not that type of thing. The other is those sorts of constraints end up running into a sort of ad hoc complaint. Like, because if the reason this argument is successful is because we just decided that God was necessary so that we could win an argument or something, then that would be a pretty strong rejoinder. But that's not what's happened. That is actually what our concept of God entails, God's self-existence, right? He's unique in this way. He's the only thing that has to exist. That's why he's the creator of everything else. So it's intrinsic to the idea of God, at least in the monotheistic religions, and certainly in Christianity, that he's self-existent. So if there were other things that were, you know, similarly all-knowing, all-powerful, morally perfect and necessary, I can't think of any, then we could make a similar sort of argument for those things. Maximally great. Yes?
So self-existent is like the same as necessary?
Yeah.
Because it just seems like even if a being is self-existent in the actual world, it seems like it would be contradicting that term as I understand it to imagine like a possible world where you just didn't self-exist.
Right, yeah. So that would mean you're rejecting one of the modal axioms, right? Which is this, that if it's possible, if it's possibly necessary, what that would mean, if it's a possible being that is necessary by definition, that it exists in a world, a way things could have been, and then automatically in every other one. And you're saying, well, that doesn't have to be the case. There are modal logics that have less axioms at work in them, and this is not a valid argument on those. But we're not suggesting that it's in valid arguments on those. So at that point, the person doesn't have an argument against this. He has an argument with the modality at work in a particular system of logic, and that would be a completely sort of separate arena that he'd have to enter into. Yeah, it's a good question. Other questions about this argument? Okay, one more last thing then about the use of it. One of the effects of the arguments from natural theology, so-called natural theology, arguments we make that ought to have premises that basically everybody can agree to and that are not principally drawn from the text of the Bible or something like that, their effect is really cumulative. So it's not, here's an argument for God's existence, and here's a different one that's utterly unrelated, and here's a different one that's utterly unrelated. It's, here's one from the definition of God, here's one from the existence of objective moral duties, here's one from the existence of motion, here's one from the complexity of the universe, here's one from biological design, here's one, it's cumulative. And they all point toward the same sort of thing. So the idea is the sort of combined weight of those is basically raising a question about the difference in worldview. And part of the apologetic task then is not really to, it's not really evangelism, you can't think of it as that, because you're not sharing the gospel at that moment, but it is trying to show that the opposing worldview, in this case one that has no God or has no belief in God, has nothing to recommend it compared to the Christian worldview, which explains much more. It explains morality and explains complexity, explains design. In fact, it even explains why people are so nasty to each other, right? And it explains why there's a God. It explains why we have a desire for the numinous. So there's all these things that it explains that the alternatives don't. And that kind of cumulative effect is part of the apologetic task, to show that that's the case and then to actually share the gospel and tell somebody what we have received, report that back to them. That's different than argument. That's a kind of proclamation. But the argument can be a part of that enterprise in developing a platform to speak in that way. Any other questions? Yes?
What do you have your doctorate in?
Philosophy of Religion and Historical Theology. I just picked the ones that would give the longest kind of... Yeah, that was my strategy, and it worked. Yes?
I'm not really sure if you went into a little detail about God's moral goodness. You said that the atheist would use, if there was like an all known, all good God, there's no perfect God, and use his moral goodness, why do bad things happen?
So there's two types of problems of evil. One of them says that because evil exists, it is logically impossible that God exists. No professional philosopher makes that argument anymore except for by historical interest. Because it's shown that it's just not true. In other words, it doesn't follow logically. There could be gobs of reasons that God's allowed evil, and I don't even have to know what they are. It's enough that there could be to show that there's no logical impossibility. So the argument that's more popular now is the argument called the evidential argument, and that says that there's pointless evils in the world. There's evils for which there could be no justification, and the idea is a morally perfect God, who was all-knowing and all-powerful, wouldn't tolerate pointless evils. But that's a probabilistic or an inductive argument. It's not a deductive one. So again, all that's left for the theist to do is to try to explain that there aren't pointless evils, right? or why God might allow evils that seemed pointless. And it's very difficult to figure out what sort of evil would actually be totally pointless. Although there's a tremendous pressure on the theist because we find in our own experience of the world that some evils don't seem justified. But it's always available to the theist to just sort of reverse the argument around, right? And to say, well, I know that God is morally perfect, so I know no evils are unjustified. I've done a book with some friends this year on the problem of evil. I'd be happy to, we'd talk about that a lot, and be happy to give you that afterwards. Yeah. Other questions about ontological argument? Yes.
You said that omnipotence was a terrible argument.
Did I use the word terrible? Maybe I did.
Because can you can do anything is a very faulty line of logic. In such a case, what is a less faulty line of logic or definition of omnipotence?
So it's one thing to say it's a faulty definition of omnipotence. And it's something else to say that's not the Christian understanding of God's omnipotence. And what I'm intending is the second one. That could be a definition of omnipotence. You can do anything. We could just say, yeah, and I don't think there are any such things, right, or something. But when we talk about God's omnipotence and the idea that there's things that he cannot do, it's actually revealed to us in the scriptures that there's things that he cannot do. Augustine answers this, relatively early, picking up a strain that's in the Church Fathers, when he says, oh, God can't sin, why not? Well, he says that actually wouldn't tend to make him any more powerful. So that is, his ability to instantiate anything doesn't actually make him better. And when we talk about his omnipotence in the theological sense, we're not saying he can just do anything. We're saying that he has a certain kind of authority and majesty and so forth. And his freedom is absolute in a way that ours is not and so forth. So the idea is if we take the omnipotent and we sort of define it outside what Christianity has historically confessed about God's omnipotence, and somebody finds that that gets rid of an idea of God, I want to say, so much the worse for that idea of God. We have this God, right? So in other words, it's just not targeting the right sort of thing. And that's the reason that it wouldn't be a terribly successful argument in my judgment. Now, if what you thought about what it meant to confess that God was omnipotent was that he can do anything, then you have to figure out how you can address problems like the paradox of the stone. Can God make a rock so big that he can't pick it up? Well, yes, okay, then there's something he can't do, pick up the rock. Oh, well, in that case, no. Okay, well, then there's something he can't do, make the rock so big he can't pick it up, right? I mean, you're hung on that kind of paradox if you have this sort of definition. But since that isn't the traditional definition of Christian theology, I don't see any reason to waste time defending it. Other questions about this? Okay, well, maybe you are shy, in which case I'll stay here afterward and you can come ask me. I think our next session is going to be the panel at 3:30 that'll be held in the chapel. Thanks so much for coming.